CBHDD is reminding people that the Georgia Crisis and Access Line can help those worried about opioid and stimulant misuse. The toll-free number is online and is active 24/7. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for being with us for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Amelia Brock and Sam Burmistaus got their second COVID shots yesterday. And because we know that the second shot can really lay some people low, when we were planning our week, we decided to give Sam and Amelia a break today, just in case. That gives us an opportunity to revisit one of the most popular conversations we've had in recent memory. Here's an encore presentation of our show featuring author Ty Sigely and Jim Galloway. You know, I don't think it comes as much of a surprise to most of you out there that we cannot seem to put the Civil War behind us here in the South. The legacy of slavery and subsequent imposition of Jim Crow laws continues to have an impact on the search for an end to systemic racism. Debate continues over how or even whether we should be memorializing Confederate leaders, white supremacists, rally around the Confederate battle flag, and in many ways see the Confederacy as a symbol for a rebellion against the United States that they believe is a just cause. And there are even still those who argue about why the South seceded in the first place. Our guest today, Brigadier General Ty Sigely, who is the Chamberlain Fellow at Hamilton College, former head of the history department at West Point, and a man who has a deep, deep knowledge and background in studying military history, is joining us today to talk about his new book, which deals with all of what I just mentioned and much more. Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause. Jim Galloway is with me today to help this conversation along. Jim, I said to Ty Sigely before we went on the air that I thought it was just appropriate that you and I would be the ones to talk to him, since you are a product of the South. You grew up in Georgia. You understand some of the same myths that he talks about in his book and that we'll discuss on this show. Whereas me, I'm a Chicago boy. I came down here in the 80s. And it was only then I began to see the complicated history of the Civil War and how it continues in some ways, Jim, to haunt Southerners. So thank you for joining this conversation. But I do want to immediately bring in Ty Sigely. By the way, Ty, thank you for allowing us to refer to you by your first name rather than your rank as a brigadier general. You served 32 years in the United States Army. But I want to start by mentioning one of the reasons you came to the attention of a great many people is I think it was in 2015 that you created a video that went viral, basically saying, was the Civil War fought for over slavery? I think you had 4-5 million people view that. It was widely controversial in some circles. But it really began your journey to try to help people understand the real roots of the Civil War. Is that a fair way to describe that?
Well, that video, I was an Army officer at West Point, and Army officers don't go viral. Historians don't go viral. And when that came out, so I did it when we had another book that came out, The West Point History of the Civil War, and I was plugging that, and I did the short video. That then I did it maybe January of 15, but it came out right after the Charleston Massacre. And so, and then it was, and this is where I realized that history is dangerous, because I said the Civil War was about slavery. I said that many people don't want to believe the citizens of the Southern states were willing to fight and die for a morally repugnant institution. And the hate mail I got from that, I got death threats to an Army officer to my West Point address. The Army investigated me was whether I was doing political speech. Of the nation, a left-leaning organization said I was a propagandist for the military. Stars and Stripes on the right side said I was too close to another political organization. So I found that, and my West Point bosses were nervous in the service about this. So I figured that after this is that is what I got from that is history is dangerous because it goes after our myths and our identities. And when we do that, when we poke that, the Civil War in a way is a dragon. And when we awaken it, it's going to breathe fire. And what I found then was that it singed me.
You know, Jim, it is astonishing. And in reading Ty's book, I recognize this more than ever, that we are still grappling with a war that was more than a century and a half earlier in our history.
Yeah, and it still has lessons for us. I mean, especially right now. I mean, I consider the Lost Cause to be probably the greatest disinformation campaign in American history. And it has survived. It has survived for better than 150 years. And it's kind of merging with the Donald Trump campaign right now.
Yeah, I think those are all really important points to make. Let's talk about this book. Ty, you begin the book by pointing out to us that having grown up in Virginia, Northern Virginia, and then in Monroe in Walton County in Georgia, when you were young, you were indoctrinated in all of the myths about the South and the Confederacy. Your favorite book, you tell us, when you were a child, was Meet Robert E. Lee, which you print an excerpt from that book. I won't bother reading the whole thing, but one of the things you loved about it was that it described him. He said he was a simple man. He had a simple faith in God, and he always did what he thought was his duty. So you revered Robert E. Lee as a child.
Oh yeah, I didn't just think he was a good guy. Reverential is right. So maybe you've seen the movie This Is Spinal Tap, you know, the first mockumentary. I love that movie. And the rock stars have an amplifier. You know exactly where I'm going with this. The rock stars have an amplifier that goes to 11, and they said, "Well, why do you have that guy? Well, it's one louder, isn't it?" Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would have rated Lee at an 11. And even though I was a good Episcopalian, went to church every Sunday, an acolyte, I would have put Jesus in the 4, 5, 6 range. Everything about my life made Lee not just a good person, but the best person ever. And I wanted to be a Southern gentleman because that was status. And I'm just honest, I wanted that status. And status came as a white man with a right religion, with the right background, and it meant being a Southern gentleman like Robert E. Lee. That's who I wanted to be. And I never looked beyond that because my books, my movies, everything about my life led me to the one true religion in a way, which was this Southern gentleman and this Lost Cause religion.
Jim, jump in.
First of all, I mean, do you consider yourself a Southern a Virginia gentleman at this point?
I don't use that term anymore. No way.
tell us a little bit about Arlington. We'll start. Let's start with Arlington. That's where you first entered elementary school. It has some history that I was not aware of. I did not know that Arlington had seceded from the District of Columbia in 1846 over slavery.
Yeah. So the idea of maybe you've seen the movie Hamilton or the play. I saw it, you know, on Disney the other day, and it says about the room where it happens, which is this idea where Madison and Jefferson and Hamilton get together and decide where the capital is going to be, and basically the Southerners give up some debt stuff, and because of that they get to put it in the slave states. Well, Washington, George Washington, says, no, you can't put it up a little bit further north. It's got to have my hometown in it, Alexandria, Virginia. And so they change the law to put it down in Alexandria, and they make a 10 square miles. And they put these, in fact, it's still there to this day, all these pillars, these granite pillars in its diamond shape. Well, it's not that diamond shape anymore. In fact, the Potomac is the one, the Potomac River is the jagged western edge of the District of Columbia. Why is that the case? Well, in 1846, they retrocede white Virginians' vote to bring Alexandria, Northern Virginia, and that area back to Virginia. Now, listen, we know governments don't give up what they have taken. That is just not the way governments work. Why do they do that? Well, Northern Virginians were fearful that the district would outlaw the non-enslavement, but outlaw the trade, the man trade, the trade in slavery. And exactly in 1850, that's what they did. So they retroceded back to Virginia. And when that happened, the white citizens of Virginia celebrated with fireworks and parades. The black citizens of Northern Virginia were wailing because black churches had to cease operation. Black schools had to stop. In fact, all free black people had to leave the state because they were now under the slave regime again. So the history of my hometown, which I had no idea about, is actually this is enmeshed in the slave trade. And then sure enough, after 1846, Alexandria becomes the hub of the slave trade, where more and more people in Northern Virginia are selling humans, selling enslaved people to the deep South, like Georgia, with these cotton, rice, and tobacco farms. So it was, and I'll tell you one other story there. So I was bused across town in Northern Virginia. I was bused from the white elementary school, completely segregated, named Douglas MacArthur, on the street named after a Confederate, to the segregated black school. And what was the name of that segregated black school? Robert E. Lee Elementary School. I mean, it's so cool. The other black elementary school was Stonewall Jackson.
Not much
so
of a choice.
So all of these were things that you learned much later in your life. So again, as a boy, first in Virginia, and then in Walton County, Georgia, here are some of the myths that you grew up believing in. Gone with the Wind helped you with your vision of the nobility of the South, the image of slaves as people who were treated with kindness and respect by their masters. We all know Mammy from that movie and her relationship with Scarlett O'Hara. Uncle Remus, the stories of Uncle Remus were a part of who you were. What did all of that tell you before your dawning awareness about the South?
Well, yeah, it really set my identity. And again, we talk about this, that our history is our identity. Our myths are who we think of ourselves. And all of these created Gone with the Wind, which I read at the age of 12 and just devoured and then read it again. It was, you know, that first book that you read as a kid when you realize that reading can be as engrossing as a TV show. Well, that was what Gone with the Wind was for me. And what they taught me was this lost cause myth of the lost cause myth. And what that is, just to explain that is, first, the war wasn't fought over slavery. And that's what Margaret Mitchell says in Gone with the Wind. She says it was this grand defense of our way of life. Well, that's just not true. It was fought for slavery. Look at Henry Benning or at other secessionists. They said we're fighting this war to prevent the abolition of our slavery. The next one was that enslaved people were happy and hardworking. Well, that's just monstrous. Slavery meant rape. It meant torture. It meant murder. And for the enslaved people, the worst is that you're going to break our families apart for profit. And a great percentage of families were broken apart in this way. The North won the war because it had more manpower, material, and money. Well, remember, the North had to mobilize like no nation ever mobilized before, come south and defeat multiple armies in an area twice the size of modern France and Germany. Another myth was that Grant was a drunk and a butcher. No, best commander of the entire war. Confederate soldiers were the best ever. In fact, it would take 12 Yankees to defeat a Confederate. Well, no, not true. By the end of the war, the South had huge problems with desertion. Another part of that myth, and Gone with the Wind probably does this more than anything. It's more of a book about Reconstruction. That is that era right after the Civil War when the North came in and tried to make a more equal society, when we had the 13th Amendment about the end of slavery, the 14th Amendment for equal rights, the 15th Amendment, which made all male citizens of the ability to vote. Well, what the South said, the white South said, was that this was an abject failure because black people weren't ready for the vote. And in fact, 2,000 black men served in high office. And then at the top of the pyramid of the lost cause myth is Robert E. Lee, the greatest man who ever lived, the greatest soldier. And yet he's got a big L on his forehead. This guy lost. And we Americans like winners.
I want to mention an image that you describe in your book as an example of how you were indoctrinated into this false belief about the relationship between slaves and masters during the war. And then, Jim, I want you to talk about a book you just discovered in your own basement. But, Ty, you describe an illustration which shows apparently a plantation owner greeting an African man who apparently has just arrived on the shores. And you describe the fact that the white man has an arm on a hand on the man's shoulder, shaking his hand with his right hand, the family standing behind him as if this is the relationship that masters and slaves had. I want to tell you something really, for me, interesting. I've been watching a Netflix series called Amend, which is hosted by Will Smith and is the story of the 14th Amendment and the civil rights movement moving forward. It was directed by our good friend here in Atlanta, Kenny Leon. And they show that illustration in the film. So they too saw how striking it was, that misdepiction of the relationship.
Yeah, that was my fourth or seventh grade textbook in Virginia, which they created to show that massive resistance to say it was a reaction to integration, a reaction to Truman forcing the South to create all humans as equal. And so they created these textbooks because they wanted to make sure white and black Virginians, boys and girls, had the correct education. So if you imagine this scene on a ship where there's a black family, an African family, and they're dressed in colonial finery, and the wife has got her hands in her head like, oh, finally, somebody is going to take care of our family. And there are two boys and two girls all dressed well, and this, you know, white colonial guy is obviously in charge. Well, it looks like they just came off a princess cruise ship. That's what it looked like. But instead, they're coming off the infamous Middle Passage of Africans coming from Africa into bondage for their lives, for their children's life forever. It's the most monstrous image that I could imagine. And yet what white Virginians, and this is written in the 1960s, was trying to show was that slavery was the best way of doing it. And that's what the Virginia legislature told the authors, make slavery look good. And I'm just so mad. I'm teed off about this, that what I got was this misinformation campaign. And the more you study enslavement, just the more horrific it becomes. I mean, the level of particularly rape, you know, most white boys had their first sexual experience with an enslaved woman during this period. There's a reason why I've an age now. I don't have grandkids yet. I'm really hoping for that soon. But white men would watch their own children and grandchildren and sell them off into slavery. And yet this picture and this textbook made it seem as though this was the best situation for everybody. It's monstrous.
Jim, you found a book that apparently was used in schools in Georgia back in, I don't know exactly what, maybe the 40s, the 50s. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, and this was happening as I was reading Ty's book. We were cleaning out the basement, of course, and we got down to the 1980s and beyond. And I come across a book called "Readings in Georgia Literature," published in 1937. I'd never seen it before, but my mother was a librarian's assistant in South Fulton County back in the 70s, and she may have picked it out of a discard pile. It was compiled a year after Gone with the Wind came out. It has an excerpt of it. But it also has five odes to Robert E. Lee in it, in essay form and in poems. One of the poems, Ty, you would recognize. It is an ode to a recumbent General Lee. The marble altar that we need to get you to elaborate on. But it also has an essay on Lee and Grant from John B. Gordon, the U.S. senator and Georgia governor, who was also kind of the author of the first iteration of the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia. And it has two essays from Alexander Stevens, one before the Civil War, where he says, oh, we ought not to go through secession. And then one after the Civil War that says, let's forget about what this Civil War was all about, that let's just agree to move along. Missing from it, of course, is his cornerstone speech made in Savannah in March of 1861, where he basically he disavows the Declaration of Independence, says not all men are not created equal, that our country is going to be based on white supremacy. And
Stevens, of course,
it's an eye opener. Yeah, it really is. And the book circulated. There are stamps on the book. It circulated into in 1960.
Yeah, this is
Stevens,
this is
of course, being the vice president of the Confederacy. Go ahead, Ty.
It's a vice president of the Confederacy and a Georgian. So, you know, you look at this and this lost cause myth, and it was done on purpose. So the thing that we've got to study, we got to remember about this lost cause and about what Stevens, the cornerstone speech, which says that we're doing this for white supremacy, that the Negro, quote unquote, Negro is inferior, always will be, always shall be. And then the way they changed the view of the Civil War, it's got a purpose. And so that's what we can never forget. But the purpose of the war was to create and ensure a slave republic, and not just in Georgia and in the South, but they wanted to go to Cuba, to Latin America, to even South America. They had these designs to spread their evil system across the world. So you have this they went to war for slavery. They lost. They sowed the wind. They reaped the whirlwind. And then after that, they had to come up with an utter defeat. I mean, 60% of Southern wealth is gone. And white Southerners who wanted to ensure white supremacy forever through slavery now had to deal with a newly freed black people. But remember that this lost cause myth, along with after the war, with segregation laws, with white terror lynching, with black disenfranchisement, Jim Crow, and Confederate monuments all formed the pillars of a society based for white supremacy to ensure white political power. Now, what you did there, and you said, I mean, you got some of those great Georgians, Alexander Stevens, we'll talk about John Brown Gordon later, I think, but they all were fighting for this idea of white supremacy. And so that's why the ideas before the Civil War aren't that much different than what comes after the Civil War. It's about creating racial control to ensure white political power then and then after the war, too.
In 1977, your family moved to Monroe, Georgia, to Walton County. And much like your experience in Northern Virginia as a child, you had no idea. First of all, you didn't realize that half the county, I think, was black, made up of black citizens, and didn't know anything about their experiences there. And it was only much later in your life, you went to a white high school where football reigns supreme. And it was only many years later that you began to understand that there was a very dark history of mistreatment of black people in Walton County.
Yeah, so we moved there in 1977, and you know it was a completely different world in Northern Virginia. I mean, even the names of the towns: Social Circle, Good Hope, Between. This was a different type of area, and I my first year in Monroe, I did not meet a black person, and the only way I ended up meeting black people was because I worked at an egg processing plant in Social Circle, and that was almost all black people that worked there. But other than that, I didn't. So what I found out when I was going there is that I went to a SEG academy. And, you know, in Georgia, finally in 1969, the federal courts ruled that all the attempts that white Georgians did to keep segregated school systems, which were enormous starting in the early 50s up through 69, that they failed. And my school, my SEG Academy, started in 1969, along with hundreds of others in the state of Georgia. They popped up like mushrooms to ensure that white kids didn't have to go to school with black kids. And that's the high school that I went to. And I had 19 people in my graduating class. But I didn't know about the terrible racial violence in Monroe. And it starts in the Reconstruction era. And they, you know, I went and found all the records of there were three KKK dens in Walton County. And it accounted for at least 10, probably more like 20% of all white men were a part of this. And they went through executing many of these people. One of the leaders of this, a guy named Jim Felker, there's still a street in downtown Monroe named after Felker. And so those have happened. And then there's the ones in the late 19th century. There's ones in the early 20th century. I mean, lynching after lynching. And then finally, which I didn't know for years, this was the site of the infamous Moore's Ford lynching, the last mass lynching in American history, in 1946, when a posse of Walton County's white citizens stalked, trapped, and then slaughtered four African Americans, two women, two men, one of whom was a veteran, and then there has still never been justice for the Morris Ford lynching. So the idea that all this was happening, and I didn't know about it until decades after I left, not only did it rage me, it made me look at myself and say, Lord, have mercy. I was living in this cauldron of racial violence, and I knew nothing about its history. And that was just the most difficult chapter for me to write, because I had to write about these lynchings, which were so horrific. And, you know, Georgia, I think, had almost 590 lynchings during this period. It was one of the most dangerous places to be a Black American in this era. And this is why we have got to study this in some depth, because it is such an awful, awful part of our history.
Jim, I want to explore Morris Ford Bridge just a little bit more in a moment. But just to make the point that history about the SEG academies that Ty went to, Fort Walton Academy, is not as long ago as we would like to think it is. It was in 1984, Jim, that Joe Frank Harris, then governor, proposed the Quality Basic Education Act in Georgia, which he did not talk about openly, really, was really designed to re-establish the formula for funding schools across the state because of the disparities caused by the old SEG school system in the state of Georgia. It's virtually contemporary history.
Right. What you would have is you would have a in local governments, you know, white dominated local governments, you would have a school board that would refuse to raise all sorts of taxes because their kids and their neighbors' kids were all going to the private academy, if you will. And so the public schools were in those areas were just starved of money. In terms of teachers, in terms of buildings, in terms of textbooks, they weren't getting what they needed.
All right, I want to talk a little bit more about Morris Ford Bridge, and then I want to talk with you, Ty, and Jim, about another role that you are now playing. Last month, actually, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin appointed you as one of four representatives of the U.S. Department of Defense to the Commission on the Naming of Items of the Department of Defense that commemorate the Confederate States of America or any person who served voluntarily with the Confederate States of America. It's a long title, but it has extraordinary implications today as we here in Georgia look at what the heck to do with all of the ways in which Confederate leaders have been honored in this state. We'll do that and a lot more when we come back on Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Let's get back to the encore presentation of one of the most popular shows we've done in recent memory. It originally aired on March 1st.
We're talking today to Ty Sigely, who retired after 32 years in the United States Army as a brigadier general who grew up in Northern Virginia, then Walton County, Georgia, believing in the myth of the lost cause. But the story of his awakening he tells in a riveting, extraordinarily candid book called Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause. Ty, we're so grateful to have you here. I do want to talk for a couple more minutes about Morris Ford Bridge, because it is one of the most heinous examples of a lynching in the state of Georgia. And Jim, you were at a protest that's around the fact that there are many people in this state, led by Tyrone Brooks, who felt that that case needed more investigation by law enforcement officials, who Tyrone Brooks and his folks felt were ignoring it.
Right, right. And then there was an incident in 1981, and Ty writes about this in his book, where I think a young black soldier from Fort Bragg, I think he was, a decomposed body was found hanging. It was officially declared a suicide. The local community had many, many doubts about that. And in fact, Ty comes up with a few new details. It turns out there was a huge protest, a huge march of African Americans from Social Circle to Monroe on that. And it just turns out I was the Klan reporter for the Atlanta Journal at the time, because you didn't want to give the Klan a lot of ink, but you still had to have somebody on the ground watching these people. So I was considered fairly expendable. But it is where I met Tyrone Brooks, because he put that together. He's the long-serving state House member who made Moore's Ford Bridge a cause.
Talk about that lynching or that death that people attributed to being a suicide that you researched, Ty.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, I knew about the Moore's Ford when I started writing the book, and I was looking as I was doing my research. I had no idea, again, my own obtuseness, that there was a lynching, and this lynching by a young black soldier from Fort Bragg. And, you know, that there were rumors that he had been with white women. Which is one of the things that, you know, the Moore's Ford Bridge or other lynchings, anytime there's this idea of black men with white women, it becomes something that is the most dangerous thing for white people. And so there were all these different rumors that came in, but they found him hanging 20 feet in the air, a couple hundred yards away from his home. And, you know, when they finally said that they ruled it a suicide, you know, the whole audience just gasped, just unbelieved, could not believe that this would another lynching, another cover up. Now, again, I don't know what happened, and I don't think there'd ever been the full investigation that we would be doing today on that. But the result, a result of this was KKK vote marching, black people and white allies marching. And I mean, when I read about the Klan, they burned Tyrone, they burned him in effigy. I mean, it was just this awful racial violence. And again, of stuff that I should have known about, but never did. And it just, again, makes me realize that, you know, this idea of racial violence and political violence is as American as apple pie.
I want to go back and talk about this transformation that you went through, in which you began to understand that the stories you'd been told were lies. And there's I think one of the most revelatory sections of your book is in which we learn from you that words really do have a meaning. So, for instance, you say to us, there's not a union. There wasn't a union army that fought the Civil War. Help us explain what the truth about that is.
Well, I grew up believing that it was, and this comes often from the Civil War centennial, 1961 to 1965, is that they were two brothers fighting. It was Union versus the Confederates. It was Johnny Reb and Billy Yank. It was Lincoln. I mean, it was Lee against Grant. And you see them as equal. These are not equal people. It was a rebel force, an insurrectionist force, unwilling to accept the Democratic election, fighting against the United States Army, the army that I wore that blue uniform for over three decades, the same that Grant wore during that war, the same uniform that George Washington picked for the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War. It's the same army. We make it seem as though, as Karl Marx would say, it was in the dustbin of history. It's the U.S. Army. So I never say the Union Army. I say the U.S. Army. Other language I say is that the South was a racial police state during the period after Reconstruction up until through the 1960s, and even, you know, some ways a little bit later. I don't call them plantations. I call them enslaved labor farms, because that's really what they are. So the idea that we're going to change our language helps us understand what these are. Plantation makes us seem like Moonlight Magnolia Scarlet waiting for iced tea from enslaved servants. And Old South. Old South doesn't mean something romantic. It means a slave society of rape, torture, murder. And so the language we use is important.
I think one of the most provocative words you use is in how you now define what Robert E. Lee was, not a general who fought nobly for the Southern cause, but you now say he was what?
He was a traitor for slavery. And I say that because he was in the Army for about the same time as I was, over 30 years, and then he chose treason. Treason is the only crime in the Constitution, and it says levying war against the United States. Did he levy war? Absolutely. He was indicted for that, never prosecuted. The second reason is I grew up saying everybody had the right to do that. Well, no, everybody did do that. No, there were 8 U.S. Army colonels from Virginia in 1861. 7 remained loyal to the United States. Lee and only Lee did it. And why? Because of his firm belief in enslavement, which he says over and over again. In fact, for 2.5 years, right before the Civil War, he gets Lee from his unit in Texas to go run enslaved labor farms at Arlington. So he's cruel. He whips people. He sells them apart for profit. This is a cruel enslaver. And then after the war, he never goes against that. He believes that black people are inferior, always will be inferior, and in fact argues that they should be kicked out of the state of Virginia.
Hey, I don't want to spoil the entire book for people because they really need to read it. They need to buy it and read it. But you have – I found one of the more striking passages in there was after you left Walton County and I think your family moved to Mobile, then you went to Washington and Lee, the university. And years ago, you were taking your wife and your kids through the chapel there. I just thought that was tell us about that. I thought that was a really striking passage.
Well, my wife is the hero of this book. She can't tell lies. She just sees the truth, which has evaded me lo these many years. So we go in there, we're with our kids, and we're down in the basement, and there's a little gift shop with a little Lee finger puppets, and there's all this stuff around there that make it look like they're this worshipful thing. But then we go up into the chapel itself, and she looks at it, and we know what churches look like. In the apse of the chapel is a white altar, and on top of the altar is Robert E. Lee. And when literally we worship Robert E. Lee there. When she sees that, she says, "Oh my God. Oh my God, you get me out of here. This place is like, I mean, it's the worst, because it's making Lee seem like God. You worship Lee and not God."
You point out in the book that there are no Christian symbols. It's all Robert E. Lee.
No Christian symbols whatsoever. No Christian symbols at all. I mean, it's absolutely incredible that there are no Christian symbols, no pulpit, nothing. And yet it's Lee Chapel. And the only thing that is looked at in that chapel, the only thing that is worshipped is Robert Edward Lee. And in fact, Traveler is down in the basement, his war horse. And his war horse actually has his own sacred place. And people come there still and put pennies on it. They put pennies. Why? Because they put pennies face down so that Lincoln's head, the hated Lincoln, can't see Robert E. Lee's tomb. And also so that Lincoln will have to kiss Traveler, the horse's butt. So this is a way that we still see Robert E. Lee as this figure of reverence. And he fought, he was a traitor to the United States of America. And why was he a traitor? For slavery. So thanks for letting me say that. Traitor for slavery.
If you can, I mean, After you've Bill, I don't know how fast you want to move to this, but I would love to talk about how Confederate symbolism made its way into West Point and into Arlington Cemetery, because the pattern is really very evocative. I mean, the Confederate battle emblem really didn't become the symbol that it is now until efforts at integration occurred in the late 40s and early 50s, and there seems to be a similar reaction that you document in both West Point and Arlington.
Arlington especially, because I want to make sure we have time also to talk about your role in terms of looking at Confederate symbols at U.S. Army bases. But talk a little bit about Arlington, because that's a particularly interesting story.
Yeah, well, Arlington, you know, is 400,000 Army heroes are buried there. And after the in 1864, Montgomery Meigs, the quartermaster of the Army, puts it was owned by Robert E. Lee and his family, his wife's family. It goes back to George Washington's time. And they had to evacuate that, the Lee family did, because it was occupied by the U.S. Army. Starting in 1864, they started making it a national cemetery, buried there. And they're one of the first integrated cemeteries in the country is right there at Arlington. And it was only U.S. soldiers until the early part of the 20th century where they start putting Confederates. But the worst part is the monument there. And that monument is a racist trope. It has a black, quote-unquote, mammy, an overweight black woman, on this monument in sacred territory for the United States of America. And she's taking a baby from her white enslaver to support him going on. It's meant to show that slavery was good, that enslaved people were happy. It was the best thing for them. It was meant to show that the South was right and the U.S. was wrong. It's the most monstrous monument in the country. And by the way, in 1923, we came within a couple of votes of putting a 40-foot mammy on Capitol Hill. So that Arlington is the worst monument that we have, the most cruel monument in the country.
All right, I've got to get to our final break of the show. We're going to come back with more on Political Rewind. We have a little time left for our conversation with Ty Sigely, author of Robert E. Lee and Me. Jim Galloway joins me for the conversation. Ty, you were appointed by Defense Secretary Austin to look at, among other things, I assume, the names assigned to U.S. Army forts here in Georgia. We have Fort Benning, we have Fort Gordon, and the question is, and one that's been debated in this country for some time now, whether or not we ought to remove the names of Confederates from U.S. Army bases. Of course, the former president of the United States didn't want to hear about it. Where do we stand on that? And tell us a little bit about, just a little about who the people who Fort Benning and Fort Gordon honor were.
Right. Well, the interesting thing about the two named in Georgia is that neither one of them ever served in U.S. Army blue. They were never served in the Army. John Brown Gordon was fought really well in the Civil War. But after the Civil War, he founded the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia and then gave a speech to black Charlestonians where he's in 1868, where he said, if you are to demand equality, black people, we will start a race war. And the 40 million of us white people will exterminate the 3 million of you black people. And then he went on to be a governor and senator in Georgia, where he fought for white supremacy and said, vote for me, vote for the Democratic Party, so that we can ensure white supremacy now and forever. So just terrible. Henry Benning was the leading fire eater. Those are the people that Fort Benning outside Columbus, Georgia, that said that we should break apart the country starting in 1849 because of we're worried about abolition. So he was and his biggest speech was given, his biggest thing he ever did was to try to break apart the United States to support slavery. And his idea of black people was apocalyptic. And he said that he would rather have famine and pestilence than black equality. And he only was a brigade commander, not a very high-ranking Confederate general, but he was the favorite of the local United Daughters of the Confederate because he was from Columbus. So he was a terrible person. So what we want to do is make sure that remember that history is about, we'll still talk about John Brown Gordon, what he did at Antietam, but what we're different is who we commemorate. Who we commemorate should be who we honor. And so I certainly want to make sure that who we honor represents the values, diversity, and courage of the American soldier.
Ty, why does this seem to be a problem kind of relegated to the U.S. Army? I mean, is it simply a historical matter? Because we don't hear discussions like this coming out of the Air Force or the Marines or the Navy.
Well, you got to remember that, first of all, the Air Force wasn't around in the Civil War.
Sure.
That helps. The second part was the Naval Academy. There weren't that many great heroes on the Confederate side because they had almost no Navy to speak of. And there were no graduates. The first graduate of Annapolis is only 1854. They don't reach high rank. And the Marines are a tiny force during the Civil War, too. The Army is always the largest force, and particularly in that war. So partly it's just because the Army is what matters in the Civil War. The other forces, I love them. Don't get me wrong, but they're just not important in the Civil War. And the ones that is important is the U.S. Navy, not the Confederate Navy. So that's the main reason. And that the Army is much more attuned to local populace because we put all these forts in these local populace. And remember, the South, when these were named, these ports were named in World War I and World War II, when the South was a racial police state. Black people did protest it, but they had no vote. They had no ability to change it. So that's why we have so many things named for Confederates, is because during World War I and World War II, we were a segregated army. We were a white supremacist army during that time, too.
Do you believe that eventually, sooner if not, or later if not sooner, your commission will be part of the effort to rename, say, Fort Benning and Fort Gordon? Is that part of your role to make recommendations about that?
Well, I think it certainly is. I mean, we're going to look at everything that's named after Confederates. That's what the law says. I mean, I'm not saying what Ty says. I'm saying what the law says. And the law says we've got to look at everything in the Department of Defense. And so I'm excited to join. I mean, I've got some really distinguished people. I'm so honored to be a part of this process. You know, I've been writing about this for the last 15 years. To be a part of this process to me is amazing. And you know, Lloyd Austin, a great Georgian, by the way, who went to West Point, I know is firmly behind this process. So I'm excited about the opportunity to serve my nation again. And you know what's so great for me is I get to take the oath. So the oath of office is one that I will take. I'll raise my right hand and give the oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. What's interesting is that oath was written in 1862. It's an anti-Confederate oath. The oath that everyone in the military takes, that everyone in Congress takes, is an anti-Confederate oath written in 1862 to ferret out traitors to the United States.
Go ahead, Jim.
Just very, very quickly. What is the morale impact? The military has become a place where many Black Americans go to get their start in life. What's the morale impact of being stationed at, say, a Fort Benning or a Fort Gordon?
Yeah, I think it's terrible. I mean, I had Black cadets that I taught that lived in Lee Barracks at West Point, and it really made them upset. And Fort Lee, which is the most diverse workplace in the country, 50% African-American there, it does make a difference because who we commemorate should represent our values. And our values in the military are about diversity, courage, and doing the right thing. And these people did the wrong thing. So it does have a huge impact. And we need to make sure that we're bringing – remember, the Army brings 10,000 people a month into the Army, 10,000 a month. So we can quickly change this narrative if we change who we commemorate, who we honor. So I think it does make a difference, and I'm just can't wait to get after this work.
Ty, many of the white supremacists, and many of whom we saw assault the United States Capitol on January 6th, were not necessarily Southerners, but they were believers in a white supremacist cause that I wonder how much you would associate with the history that you've mined in your book. In other words, to what extent does the lost cause, the fact that the South did rebel treacherously against the United States, to what extent do you think that informs the white supremacist movement of today, or do you see it as an entirely different proposition?
Well, it's a great question. If I didn't see the flag of treason, that battle flag of the Confederacy going into the Capitol. And in fact, it went right by Charles Sumner. And Charles Sumner was an abolitionist who was nearly caned to death by Preston Brooks, the South Carolinian, in 1857 for excoriating enslavers. And that Charles Sumner is the guy that wrote the oath I just told you about. So when I saw that flag go through there, I know that there's a link because that flag has always meant white supremacy. It meant it in 1861 to 1865. It meant it in 1956 when Georgia added that Confederate battle flag to its flag. When I lived in Georgia, that Confederate battle flag was part of the state flag. It means that now, even though Georgia's flag continues to be an homage to the Confederate flag. So as long as we have these symbols which represent white supremacy and people are carrying them, that's exactly what it means. So yes, there's a direct link to white supremacy.
Jim, just looking at Georgia history, we all know, we both know, because we covered it extensively, what happened when Roy Barnes tried to change the battle flag, the Georgia flag, to remove an emblem of the Confederacy from it and the controversy it caused. I'm curious, Jim, do you think we've grown as a state since then? And then a corollary question to you, Ty, after Jim. Do you think we're moving in the right direction? Are more and more people understanding what you do now? But Jim, very quickly, because we're short on time, talk. What about Georgians? Have we learned from our past?
I'm not sure that grown is the right word. We have changed. And part of that is the fact that we do have we have a new generation. People, old people are dying out. People who were educated with that 1937 textbook are going away. And you have many, many African Americans moving back south. So I think that's a good part of it.
Ty, wrap us up.
Yep, I think we are changing. But remember, history is dangerous because it goes after our myths and our identities. And it's incumbent upon us to understand that. So if we want to ensure the only way to ensure that we don't have a racist future is to first understand our racist past. We must acknowledge and embrace who we are and who we were if we want to have a more just society.
Ty Sedgley's book is Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause. Sedgley grew up in Northern Virginia and in Walton County, Georgia. Through his early years, he was taught about the glorious history of the Confederate fight for freedom, led by the man who became his hero, Robert E. Lee. Sedgley's book tells the story of his awakening into the reality of the secession, which he now calls a traitorous rebellion against the United States. Jim Galloway and I talked with Sedgley on March 1st, and it became one of our most popular shows in recent memory. That's it for us for today. I'll be back with another live Political Rewind tomorrow. In the meantime, take care, stay healthy, wear a mask, and get your shot.